At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I feel bad. So said a subdued President Obama today after voters delivered what he called a shellacking. Today, a look at the newly shellacked economic picture in Washington. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad to have you with us on this Wednesday, November 3rd. And looking toward a shift in power on Capitol Hill, the word of the day was compromise. President Obama is pledging to work with Republicans after they seized control over the House of Representatives. But as he spoke to reporters today, he stuck to most of his economic positions, even as he acknowledged that new Republican power in Congress brings added pressure to rein in government spending. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale joins us now. And John, that's how the Republicans rode to victory on their vow to control spending. So how do they propose to do that?
Well, they're short on specifics. For one thing, they want to stop spending any more stimulus money. But, you know, most of that $700 billion is already out the door. Uncommitted stimulus money is in the range of about $20 to $50 billion, but not enough to make much of a difference. Mm-hmm. House Republicans have talked about an across-the-board freeze on discretionary spending. That's the shrinking part of the federal budget that isn't mandated by Social Security or other entitlement programs. And this morning, the probable Speaker of the House next year, John Boehner, was asked his intentions on getting spending under control.
I believe that operating under the 2008 levels of spending before the bailouts, before the stimulus, is a responsible way forward.
But that stimulus, by some measures at least, helped avoid a more severe economic downturn, John. For a while during the credit crisis, in fact, it seemed Uncle Sam was the only one spending any money, even though it was borrowed money. Can turning off the government tap be good for the fragile recovery?
Well, that's certainly a concern for a number of economists and Democrats. One of them is Robert Shapiro. He worked in the Clinton administration. He was an outside advisor to the White House when Republicans took over the House in 1994. He points out that Japan cut off its government stimulus too early in 1998, and they slid back into recession.
There is no serious economics that says in an environment in which you have very slow growth, and in particular with very low interest rates, that what makes sense is fiscal austerity.
But, you know, we may be about to find out what makes sense, because this election is likely to bring in a wave of austerity from Congress, especially from new Tea Party members. Democrats might worry about stalling the economy, but former Republican Congressman Vin Weber from Minnesota says Republicans see things differently.
They believe quite the contrary, that the amount of debt that we're adding is putting adverse pressure on the credit markets and creating long-term uncertainty about the United States' fiscal viability, and the cutting down on spending will actually be helpful to the economy. But it's clearly a clash of ideologies and economic ideologies.
Okay, what about those Bush tax cuts that are set to expire? They're obviously popular. They helped get a lot of Republicans elected. Will Republicans push for them, even though that could increase the debt?
Well, they will. They say that more money in people's pockets will get the economy going eventually over the long term and bring down the deficit as the strong economy creates more tax revenue. The Democrats say, well, we tried that sort of trickle-down theory before and it didn't work. And if the government's going to live within its means, citizens, especially those who've benefited the most, are going to have to sacrifice. It's just another one of those ideological clashes that weren't resolved by yesterday's election.
John Dimsdale, thanks.
Thank you.
Republicans are claiming they've won a mandate to repeal President Obama's health care overhaul. They're also promising to take a close look at the new financial reform law the president pushed through Congress. But in those cases, too, GOP leaders have shied away from specifics. Could they overturn either law? We asked Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer to take a look.
Presumptive House Speaker John Boehner says he'll start to roll back what he calls the health care monstrosity. But repealing that law is almost impossible. The GOP only won control of the House. Any House bill would hit the Senate's buzzsaw. And, of course, President Obama has veto power. It's the same deal for financial reform. But a GOP-controlled House could starve federal agencies that implement new laws. Teddy Downey is a policy analyst at MF Global.
You know, you try to just block the funding process and the legislative process so that everything grinds to a halt.
Consider the Securities and Exchange Commission. It was given lots of new responsibilities. Jennifer Taub teaches business law at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
They were given these obligations and powers with the understanding that they would have their budget almost doubled.
To do things like hire the best and brightest to oversee trading of complicated financial instruments like derivatives. Republicans can also delay things by holding lots of oversight hearings. Boehner hinted at that kind of strategy earlier today.
I think one of the things that Congress has not done a very good job of over the last 15 years is real oversight of the executive branch, which is a constitutional responsibility of the Congress.
The Senate is responsible for confirming the heads of new bureaus and offices established by the health care and financial overhauls. Again, Republicans don't control the Senate, but they could hold up those confirmation votes. Taub says that's the reverse of what's needed. Think of the new laws as children, she says.
The legislation itself, the code, is like the DNA, and we need a combination of both nature and nurture for it to thrive.
But that may be difficult in the current political environment, especially since Republicans are looking ahead to the 2012 elections, when they could take over Congress and the White House and have the ability to finally repeal the health care and financial overhaul laws. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street seemed to vote its approval on this election day after. That and some political accounting when we do the numbers. A divided Congress raises lots of interesting questions, perhaps foremost among them, what it will mean for the economy. In the last few years, Congress has played a central role in enacting laws designed to stimulate the economy. Now, potential gridlock puts more pressure to act on the Federal Reserve. And it did act today. The Fed announced it is going to buy $600 billion worth of government bonds in something the wonks call quantitative easing. From New York, Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at what it might do and what a GOP-controlled House might mean for the nation's central bank.
Quantitative easing is kind of like monetary policy meets shopping spree. Karen Petru is with Federal Financial Analytics.
Quantitative easing is when the government buys a lot of something. Treasury bills, Fannie or Freddie bonds.
The Federal Reserve buys those bonds from banks. To pay for them, the Fed essentially prints money. Then it hopes for a trickle-down effect. Interest rates stay low, banks lend, people and businesses borrow and spend. It's an indirect stimulus to the economy, and it might not work. The Federal Reserve tried quantitative easing 2 years ago to the tune of roughly $2 trillion, and the banks didn't exactly start handing out loans.
It paints a picture of, frankly, a last resort.
That's political and financial analyst Chuck Gabriel. He says Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke has already pushed the limits of what the Fed can do.
You've got to give Bernanke and company incredible marks for innovation. He created so many credit facilities during the dark days of 08 and 09. He was just a maestro.
But he may be running out of instruments. At the very moment the Fed takes center stage in reviving the economy, its power could come under scrutiny from the new Congress, says analyst Karen Petrou.
I think we're going to see one of the greatest challenges to the Federal Reserve structure.
Petrou says financial reform already put strong limits on the Federal Reserve, and newly empowered House Republicans are expected to try to rein the Fed in even more. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Given the tough political decisions in the tough economy, budgets in several states came in late this year. Way late here in California, 100 days past the due date. Tax refunds got held up, workers weren't paid on time, and people got mad. Last night, voters passed a measure aimed at making it easier to pass a budget. But as Eve Trow reports, it doesn't help the underlying problem that California is broke.
The ad said Proposition 25 would light a fire under California lawmakers to pass a budget on time.
With Prop 25, legislators lose their pay and benefits for every day the budget is late, permanently.
I don't do my job. I don't get paid. Why should they?
That appealed to angry voters. 55% of them said yes. California had the nation's highest bar to pass a budget, a two-thirds vote in the legislature. Prop 25 lowers that to a simple majority.
And maybe we can get the state budget process back on track.
Nancy Sidhu is with the Los Angeles Economic Development Foundation. And she said budget process because fewer people now have to agree on the budget. But Prop 25 keeps another high hurdle in place. It still takes a two-thirds majority to raise taxes to fund the budget. Dan Smith at the Sacramento Bee says that's how voters wanted it.
They felt that their protection on taxes was intact. It's still just as difficult to raise taxes.
It's the same story in many places. Voters want services, but not higher taxes to pay for them. California has a $19 billion budget gap. Economist Nancy Sidhu says Prop 25 doesn't do anything to close it.
The amounts that are proposed for spending on the one hand vastly exceed the amount of revenue coming into state coffers.
And she says that leaves California just as broke as it was before Election Day. In Los Angeles, I'm Eve Trow for Marketplace.
General Motors just took some of the wraps off its newest offering, the initial public offering that will price its stock, we learned today, at between $26 and $29 a share. That was the carmaker's announcement in a filing with the Securities and Exchange Commission. GM also forecast its third quarter earnings at close to $2 billion. And it says the bottom line will reflect a profit this year. Another vote caught our eye today, but it had less to do with Republicans and Democrats toying around with politics and more to do with the trinkets in all those so-called happy meals. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors is banning restaurants from giving away toys in certain kids' meals, ones with too many calories and too few fruits and vegetables, typically the fast food kind. So that got us wondering, how much is the happy in the happy meal really worth? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
For kids, the McNuggets and fries are only part of the fun.
You can get wickedly tasty food,
delicious,
and a super toy from the new DreamWorks movie, Megamind. There's one in your McDonald's Happy Meal.
For now. But if you're a kid in San Francisco or parts of Silicon Valley, there won't be any toys next year. Officials are banning toys in kids' meals that are high in fat and have more than 600 calories. Daniel Conway is spokesman for the California Restaurant Association.
Kids in San Francisco are going to be opening boxes next December and be very disappointed to see that they're empty.
They won't be the only ones. The top fast food chains sell more than a billion meals a year to kids. Margot Wu-Tan is with the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
Our kids begging us to go to McDonald's to get the latest toy tied into their favorite movie means the whole family ends up eating at McDonald's.
Happy Meal toys like Megamind can also be worth millions in licensing deals and free advertising to movie companies. Edward J. Epstein is author of The Hollywood Economist. He says that toy tie-ins can determine whether a studio actually makes a movie or not.
They certainly can't put up the money themselves. They're already strained in their advertising budgets, so they might decide
not to do this particular movie.
Yet another reason to cry into those burgers and fries. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
So what do you think? Should toys be banned from kids' meals? Take our poll at marketplace.org. Coming up, find out why Boomtown could now be synonymous with one Inner Mongolian city.
Ordos produces a sixth of China's coal and a third of its natural gas.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, if yesterday's midterm election was a swinging pendulum, today's stock market was a yo-yo. The Dow Jones Industrial Average sank, spiked, and sank again after the Federal Reserve announcement. It finished up 26 points, or 0.25%, to close at 11,215. The NASDAQ gained 6 points, also about 0.25%, to finish at 2540. The S&P 500 rose 4 points, more than 0.33%, to end the day at 1197. The real numbers for this day after election come with dollar signs in front of them. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, candidates, parties, and outside groups spent a staggering $3.9 billion in pursuit of elective office this cycle. In raw numbers, Meg Whitman topped the list, $160 million. On a votes-per-dollar basis, the winner, well, loser actually, was probably Linda McMahon. In the Connecticut Senate race, she spent almost $42 million, $90 for every vote she got. But one more thing, only 734 days until the 2012 elections.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. By Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com. And by Vanguard, whose mission is to simplify investing and to help people reach their financial goals at vanguard.com/public radio. What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
State Book, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases its productivity and costs report for the third quarter. Shopping in October? We'll see. Chain stores release monthly sales data. And service members who have been injured in the line of duty discuss their experiences at the United States Navy Memorial. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdahl. Just when you thought you might be free of the political soundbite for a while, consider today the unofficial kickoff of the 2012 presidential campaign. Commentator Robert Reich says that poses a big question for President Obama. Should he borrow Bill Clinton's olive branch to the GOP in 1996?
I want us to forge a partnership to produce results for the American people.
Or should he emulate FDR's approach in 1936?
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
Some people are going to tell President Obama that Bill Clinton was reelected in 1996 because he moved to the center, and Obama should too. But Clinton was really reelected because by 1996, the economy had come roaring back to life. President Obama won't have that luxury in 2012. In all likelihood, the economy will still be anemic. It's now growing at the rate of no more than 2% a year, not enough to reduce unemployment. And it's doubtful that over the next 2 years, consumers will buy enough to change that. For the next 2 years, Republicans will try to paint Obama as a big government liberal who's responsible for the continuing bad economy. Obama's best hope for re-election will be to reframe the debate, making the central issue the power of big business and Wall Street to gain economic advantage at the expense of the rest of us. The relevant political lesson isn't Bill Clinton in 1996. It's Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1936. By 1936, the Great Depression was entering its eighth year. Roosevelt had already been president for four of them. Yet he won the biggest electoral victory since the start of the two-party system in the 1850s. How? He shifted the debate from his failure to get the economy moving to the irresponsibility of his opponents. Republicans, he said, stood for business and financial monopoly, speculation, and reckless banking. And Roosevelt made clear his opponents wanted to stop him from helping ordinary Americans. Never before have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today, he thundered. They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred. Hopefully, the 2012 economy won't be as bad as the economy was in 1936, but there's no way it's going to be nearly as good as it was in 1996. For President Obama, 1936 provides the real lesson.
Robert Reich was Secretary of Labor for President Clinton. His new book is called Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. We'll hear from conservative commentator David Frum next Wednesday. And as always, your thoughts are welcome at marketplace.org. Got word at the end of last week that the American economy is still lumbering along at an annual growth rate of only 2%. China's GDP, on the other hand, is racing ahead at more than 9% a year. Coal is the fuel behind that growth, and most of it comes from the Chinese province of Inner Mongolia. It was once one of the country's poorest areas, but now the Inner Mongolian city of Ordos has the highest economic growth per capita of any city in China. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has the first of two reports on the boom time on China's grasslands.
A decade ago, people here in Ordos got around by tractor, horseback, or they simply walked. These days, they prefer Land Rovers, BMWs, or if Liu Yongxi has his way, Porsches. Liu shows off a retrofitted Porsche to a customer at his dealership. The car costs $350,000. He says he sells two of these a week, usually to mining executives and real estate developers who lug in suitcases full of cash to buy them.
Many people here in Ordos, they become rich all of a sudden, but they don't know where to invest their money.
Businessman Wu Jinping wants to help lighten their wallets. The local government has given his company startup funds to build an automobile industrial park devoted to selling luxury cars.
You see, this is our big plan.
Wu shows off a 3D model of the planned park. It's peppered with dozens of miniature warehouses and skyscrapers overlooking tiny green forests. A river with bright blue plastic water meanders through lush green pasture. It's a landscape reminiscent of the American Midwest. But there's a problem. Ordos is located in a desert. Wu admits the model exaggerates a little. For example, the bright blue river has actually gone dry.
There's no more river?
No river, no, never. On our plan, we're gonna build a automobile park.
Oh,
like
I see.
Car racing.
So you'll be able to race your cars down the dry riverbed then?
Right, right.
Oh, okay.
This auto park will be number one in China.
Before it's number one, though, a development on this scale is going to need some major investment, about $600 million.
And you've secured that investment?
We can manage to do it.
Wu gives me a self-assured, almost cocky smile. It's a smile you see on many faces here. A massive infusion of capital is behind it. Ordos produces a sixth of China's coal and a third of its natural gas. The region has become rich by supplying the fuel for China's development boom. But it's also fueled an obsession to build monumental projects that are difficult for visitors to comprehend, like this one. Workers put the finishing touches on the new city of Ordos. You see, Ordos has so much money that city leaders want to move the population 15 miles away to a location with better access to water. The government spent $1 billion to create an entirely new city called Kangbashi. It's got a huge public square, museums, concert halls, and row upon row of high-rise apartments just waiting for people to move in. Problem is, nobody seems to have gotten the memo. Just 30,000 people live in a city built for 300,000. Tang Lina is one of them. She admits living in a city the size of Pittsburgh that's largely vacant is starting to become spooky.
Life isn't very convenient here. The nearest supermarket is half an hour away. My main concern is what'll happen now. Will people start to move here? There are still a lot of empty properties.
The Ordos government ignored requests for an interview. They've told the Chinese press, though, to give it time. The region's population is currently at 1.5 million and growing quickly. In the meantime, the new city will have to stand empty and wait.
The factors that have led to a ghost town in Ordos are factors that are actually present throughout China.
Tsinghua University business professor Patrick Shevanek says Ordos might be lonely, but it's not alone. There are several other empty swaths of urban China. They're the result of having a lot of money, but nowhere to park it. China has a closed capital account, which means people can't invest outside the country. Playing the stock market's too risky. They could put money in the bank, but they'd earn less than 2% interest. That's less than the inflation rate.
People are flush with cash and they don't really have that many outlets for it, so they have to put it somewhere. And in a Chinese economy right now, the only place that you can put it and feel somewhat confident that you're retaining your value is in real estate, even if you're buying 10 empty units in a city that nobody lives in.
Qian Xuefeng exudes this confidence. The 40-year-old spent the equivalent of $120,000 on this modern-looking three-bedroom apartment in a mostly empty city.
Now I have two cars, a laptop, and I live in such a big apartment. I'd never thought about all these when I was young. My dreams have come true.
Tian says the city may be vacant now, but just watch, he says. In 5 years, it'll be full. Tian rolls his eyes when I bring up all the property here bought by speculators. How can that be a problem, he asks. And then he points at me. People in your country, he says, slipping into an almost lecturing tone, they speculate too. Reporting from Ordos, China, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Rob continues his look here at the boom time on China's grasslands. You can also hear more on tomorrow's Marketplace Morning Report and check out Rob's photos of Inner Mongolia at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by PBS, taking you deep inside the world of the Big Top. Circus, starting tonight at 9, 8 Central on PBS. By Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at microsoft.com/cloud. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, the lion just squeaked. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer filed for bankruptcy protection today. The studio of James Bond has been planning this for more than a year and finally won approval from its lenders. MGM plans to merge with Spyglass Entertainment, whose co-CEOs will lead the combined company. MGM is one of the studios involved in making The Hobbit prequel to the Lord of the Rings trilogy, but not to worry, my little precious, as one of that film's characters might say, the company is seeking permission to start funding its half of the Hobbit production from newly borrowed money. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 26 points, or 0.25%. The Nasdaq gained 6 points, also about 0.25%. The S&P 500 rose 4 points, more than 0.33%. Mahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this program, when you think of Detroit, what image comes to mind?
We're not in this barren land where all you see is desolation. There are a lot of good things that are going on here.
A conversation with the mayor of the Motor City, Dave Bing. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too.
Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.